Nomoto presents American Presidents. President Dwight Eisenhower. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 22 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On a raw January morning in 1953, as a cold wind cut across the National Mall, a former five-star general stood on the podium of the Capitol, hand on a Bible, about to become President of the United States. Dwight David Eisenhower, Ike, to practically everyone, was 62 years old, broad-shouldered, with a square, reassuring face that had stared out from war posters and newsreels throughout the 1940s. The crowds that lined Pennsylvania Avenue did not see a politician in the usual sense. They saw the man who had commanded Allied armies in Europe, the soldier who had overseen D-Day and watched Nazi Germany fall. To many Americans, his election felt less like a partisan victory than an act of national common sense. The country, weary of Korea and anxious about the Cold War, had turned to the general who had already led them through one global crisis. Yet the story that brought Eisenhower to that platform was not a simple march from battlefield to presidency. It began far from Washington and West Point, in a small, dusty Kansas town where a poor family raised six boys in a house that felt permanently on the edge of barely making it. Dwight Eisenhower was born in 1890 in Denison, Texas, but his real hometown was Abilene, Kansas, where the family moved when he was still a small child. Abilene was a cowtown turned farm center on the plains, a place of wheat fields, muddy streets, and hard winters. His parents, David and Ida Eisenhower, were devout, disciplined, and chronically short of cash. David worked at a creamery. Ida ran the household with an iron sense of frugality. The Eisenhower boys slept in the same room. They shared clothes and chores and the rough affection of brothers who were always half fighting, half protecting one another. From an early age, Dwight, known in the family as Ike, a nickname that stuck to all the Eisenhower boys in one form or another, showed more enthusiasm for sports and pranks than for schoolwork. He loved baseball and football. He organized neighborhood games, climbed trees, and occasionally found himself in trouble. But beneath the mischief lay a solid, steady character. He admired his mother's quiet strength and his father's stern honesty. He absorbed the notion that you should take responsibility for your own mistakes and never push blame onto others. Money was tight enough that college looked like a distant dream. Dwight graduated from Abilene High School in 1909 and took a job at the local creamery to help pay for his younger brother Edgar's education. But he also began to look for a way out of the narrow horizons of small-town life. A friend mentioned that the service academies, West Point and Annapolis, offered free tuition in exchange for military service. Eisenhower saw a route into a larger world. With help from a local congressman, he secured an appointment to the United States Military Academy at West Point, arriving there in 1911. West Point in the early 20th century was a place of rigid discipline and relentless rules. Eisenhower chafed at some of it. He picked up demerits for small infractions, played cards when he should have been studying, and sustained a serious knee injury playing football that ended any hope of a professional sports career. But he also learned the habits that would define his later leadership: an ability to size people up quickly, a knack for organization, and a calmness under pressure that made classmates trust him instinctively. He was not at the top of his class academically. He graduated in the middle, but he absorbed the professional ethos of the officer corps. Commissioned as a second lieutenant in 1915, Eisenhower expected, like many young officers of his generation, to see action in World War I. Instead, the Army assigned him to training posts in the United States. He organized tank units in Pennsylvania and Georgia, drilling recruits in the new technology of mechanized warfare. The war ended before he could join the fighting overseas. He felt disappointed, even guilty, worrying that he had missed his chance to prove himself in battle. That sense of having something still to prove would linger. During these early army years, he married Mamie Dowd, the daughter of a well-off Denver family. Mamie was lively, social, and far more comfortable with parties and small talk than the sometimes reserved Ike. They married in 1916 and began a life that would see them shuttling from post to post, Texas, Maryland, the Panama Canal Zone, the Philippines. They had two sons. The first, little Dowd Dwight, died of scarlet fever at age 3, a loss that nearly crushed them. The second, John, lived and would later become a West Point graduate and Army officer himself. Between the wars, Eisenhower slowly climbed the ranks. He served under men who would shape his thinking. Fox Connor, a thoughtful officer in the Panama Canal Zone, introduced him to the complexities of coalition warfare and the history of European conflicts. Later, serving under General Douglas MacArthur in the Philippines, Eisenhower saw both the brilliance and the vanity of one of America's most famous soldiers. He learned from MacArthur's daring, but also made mental notes about the dangers of ego and theatricality in command. For years, his promotions were slow. The interwar army was small, and advancement came by seniority, as much as merit. Eisenhower reached his 40s, still a relatively obscure lieutenant colonel. It was only when the world lurched toward another great conflict that events finally caught up with his abilities. When World War II broke out in Europe and Asia, the United States remained officially neutral, but President Franklin Roosevelt began expanding the army and planning for the possibility of entry into the war. Eisenhower's talent for staff work, planning, logistics, coordination, brought him to Washington in 1941. After Pearl Harbor, he was catapulted upward, first as a planner for the Army's chief of staff, George C. Marshall, then as a theater commander overseas. Marshall saw in Eisenhower a rare combination of strategic vision, organizational skill, and personal modesty. Where some generals craved glory, Eisenhower seemed content to make things work. In 1942, he was sent to London to command American forces in Europe. Soon he was supreme commander of Allied forces in the Mediterranean and then in Northwest Europe. His job was less about tactical brilliance on a single battlefield than about orchestrating a vast alliance. Americans, British, Canadians, Free French, and others, each with their own politics, rivalries, and egos. He supervised Operation Torch, the Allied landings in North Africa in 1942. It was a messy, complicated campaign, but it gave Eisenhower experience managing coalition warfare under fire. Then came the invasion of Sicily and the push into Italy. Above all, there was Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion of Normandy in June 1944. Eisenhower bore the ultimate responsibility for launching the greatest amphibious assault in history. The night before the landings, after weather delays and fierce debate, he gave the order to go. He also drafted, and stuck in his wallet, a brief note taking full blame in case the landings failed. "If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt," he wrote, "it is mine alone." The invasion succeeded, at enormous cost, and the note stayed in his pocket, a private testament to his sense of responsibility. By the time Germany surrendered in May 1945, Eisenhower was one of the most famous men in the world. His picture had been on magazine covers, towns named streets after him. He returned home not only as a victorious general, but as a symbol of Allied cooperation and American competence. After a brief stint as Army Chief of Staff, he became president of Columbia University and later the first supreme commander of NATO, organizing the new Western alliance against Soviet power. Both parties courted him for the presidency. For a time, no one was entirely sure which ticket he would choose. In the end, he declared himself a Republican and accepted their nomination in 1952, running with California Senator Richard Nixon as his running mate. His campaign slogan, "I like Ike," was simple and effective. Voters, battered by years of war, Cold War tensions, and the stalemated conflict in Korea, gravitated toward his calm, non-ideological persona. He promised to go to Korea himself if elected to see whether peace could be achieved. He won comfortably, ending 20 years of Democratic control of the White House. As president, Eisenhower faced a complex set of challenges, ending the Korean War, managing nuclear weapons and the arms race, containing communism without bankrupting the country, and guiding a society on the edge of transformation in civil rights and prosperity. His style was often misunderstood. To some contemporaries, especially intellectuals, he seemed disengaged, even simple. His language could be awkward, his syntax tangled. But behind the genial smile and the golf outings was a man who believed in careful delegation and quiet control. He ran the White House like the headquarters of a large military command. He let subordinates argue, then made decisions and expected them to be carried out. But true to his campaign promise, Eisenhower visited Korea before taking office and concluded that the war had to end. He signaled, through diplomatic channels and military posture, that the United States would not rule out severe measures if fighting continued, while at the same time being willing to settle for an armistice rather than total victory. In July 1953, an armistice agreement was signed. The war ended not with a peace treaty, but with a truce line that still divides the Korean Peninsula today. For Americans, the guns fell silent, the sense of endless stalemate eased. Strategically, Eisenhower believed that the United States could not sustain a huge standing conventional army indefinitely without undermining its own economy. His administration adopted what came to be called the New Look, relying more heavily on nuclear deterrence and air power while limiting ground forces. The doctrine of massive retaliation, articulated by his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, declared that the United States would respond to communist aggression with overwhelming force, possibly including nuclear weapons. The aim was to deter war by making its potential cost unimaginably high. At the same time, Eisenhower understood, perhaps better than many critics, the moral and practical dangers of nuclear weapons. He proposed, in his Atoms for Peace speech at the United Nations, that the great powers share nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and work towards some form of arms control. These efforts bore limited fruit during his presidency, but they showed a side of Eisenhower that later generations would recognize more clearly, a realist who had seen war close up and who wanted to prevent another global catastrophe. The Cold War during his years in office was not a series of direct clashes between American and Soviet armies, but a pattern of crises on the periphery. The French defeat at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam, the CIA-backed overthrow of governments in Iran and Guatemala, the 1956 Suez Crisis, the Hungarian uprising, and its brutal suppression by Soviet tanks. Eisenhower walked a line between confrontation and compromise. He refused to intervene militarily in Hungary, knowing that confronting Soviet forces in their own sphere could trigger a wider war, but he opposed Britain, France, and Israel when they invaded Egypt to seize the Suez Canal, pressuring them to withdraw through economic leverage. It was a striking moment, a World War II general telling old European empires that their age of independent action was over. At home, his presidency saw booming prosperity. The post-war economy expanded, suburban neighborhoods spread across the landscape, and consumer culture deepened. One of Eisenhower's most enduring domestic achievements was the interstate highway system. Inspired partly by his experience in a grueling 1919 Army convoy that crossed the country on bad roads and partly by admiration for Germany's Autobahn network, he pushed for a national system of multi-lane highways. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 launched the program. Over decades, it would reshape American life, enabling long-distance trucking, commuting from suburbs, and the particular car-centered geography that still defines much of the United States. Civil rights posed a different kind of test. Eisenhower was not, by temperament or upbringing, a crusader on racial issues. He had grown up in a largely white Kansas town and spent much of his adult life within the relatively insulated world of the Army. Privately, he expressed unease about sudden social change. But he also believed in the rule of law and in the dignity of individual citizens. In 1954, the Supreme Court issued its landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education, declaring racial segregation in public schools unconstitutional. The ruling came from the judiciary, not the executive, but it landed squarely on Eisenhower's desk in terms of enforcement. The crisis that forced his hand came in Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1957, when 9 black students attempted to integrate Central High School under a federal court order. The state's governor, Orville Faubus, used the National Guard to block their entry. Photographs of angry white mobs and terrified teenagers flashed around the world. Eisenhower, who disliked federal intervention in local affairs, initially hoped to resolve the crisis quietly. When that failed, he made a fateful decision. He federalized the Arkansas National Guard, removed it from the governor's control, and sent in the 101st Airborne Division to escort the students into school. It was a stunning sight. A Republican president, former Supreme Allied Commander, using federal troops to enforce civil rights against a defiant Southern governor. Whatever his personal reservations, Eisenhower had acted to uphold the law and the authority of the federal courts. As his second term progressed, Eisenhower faced new pressures. The Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first artificial satellite, in 1957, shocking Americans and sparking fears of a missile gap. The critics accused his administration of complacency in science and education. In response, he supported the creation of NASA and backed federal aid for science and math in schools. He also quietly expanded America's own missile and reconnaissance programs, including the U-2 spy planes that photographed Soviet installations from high altitude. In 1960, near the end of his presidency, a U-2 piloted by Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union. At first, the United States issued a cover story about a weather research plane. When Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev produced the captured pilot and wreckage, Eisenhower faced a choice: deny and risk deeper humiliation, or admit the truth. He chose candor, acknowledging that the flights had been authorized to gather information in a dangerously opaque nuclear standoff. A planned summit with Khrushchev collapsed in acrimony. It was one of the lowest points of his presidency, but it reflected his willingness to take personal responsibility rather than hang subordinates out to dry. By the time he left office in 1961, Eisenhower was both widely liked and, in some quarters, underestimated. Younger, more glamorous figures such as John F. Kennedy seemed to embody a new, forward-leaning style of leadership. Intellectuals who had bristled at Eisenhower's plain speech saw in him an old soldier out of step with the times. Yet on his last full day in office, he delivered a farewell address that would grow in stature over the decades. In it, he warned of the emergence of a military-industrial complex, the close partnership between the armed forces, defense contractors, and political institutions that could, if left unchecked, gain unwarranted influence and endanger democratic processes. The warning rang with special authority because it came from a career soldier who had presided over the building of that very apparatus. Eisenhower was not calling for disarmament. He understood better than almost anyone the need for strength in a dangerous world. But he also feared that permanent mobilization and vast defense spending could distort national priorities, placing power in the hands of those whose livelihoods depended on perpetual readiness for war. It was a subtle, sober message, and for a long time it was overshadowed by the glamour of his successor. Only later, as the Cold War deepened and the defense establishment grew, did many Americans realize how prescient it had been. In retirement, Eisenhower returned to a farm near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where he and Mamie entertained visitors, doted on grandchildren, and watched politics from a distance. He painted, golfed, and wrote his memoirs. Presidents from both parties sought his counsel. Kennedy invited him to the White House during the Berlin and Cuba crises. Lyndon Johnson asked his advice on Vietnam. They found a man who still believed in alliances, fiscal prudence, and patience, qualities sometimes in short supply in the television age. Dwight D. Eisenhower died in 1969 as the country he had once led through relatively calm, prosperous years now tore itself apart over Vietnam, civil rights, and generational revolt. For a time, his reputation sank. Historians talked about an era of hidden hand, politics, and supposed stagnation. But as archives opened and memories cooled, a reassessment began. Scholars found in his papers evidence of deliberate, sometimes subtle management. They saw that he had quietly resisted pressure for reckless military action, maintained balanced budgets more often than not, and presided over 8 years without a single major American soldier killed in combat after Korea ended. For listeners tracing the line of presidents, Eisenhower stands as a bridge between the total wars of the first half of the 20th century and the uneasy peace of the nuclear age. He was a man shaped by small-town hardship, interwar frustration, and the terrible responsibilities of global command. As president, he favored stability over drama, caution over grand gestures. Yet in that caution lay a kind of strength. He kept the Cold War from turning hot, oversaw years of growth, enforced desegregation when the law demanded it, and left behind not just highways and alliances, but a warning about the dangers of unchecked power that still resonates. He was, in many ways, precisely what mid-century America needed, a leader who had seen the worst the world could do and was determined, as far as his office allowed, to keep his country both strong and sane.